Hello and welcome to yet another exciting, and I mean that quite wrongly, episode of Cooper Talks. And for this one, I'm following on from the last one, talking about the Cold War and looking at the origins of the Cold War, maybe thinking who was to blame, which is a common sort of exam topic, exam theme for this, but maybe better to think about what was to blame and why did it happen. Rather than blame, because who wins if we blame people? Anyway, following on from the conferences, Tehran, Yalta, and then Potsdam, we get the Cold War sort of stepping up a gear. The main thing that happens following on from Potsdam is the establishment of a Soviet-controlled sphere in Eastern Europe. Now, why this happened matters some debate. It's worth bearing in mind the context that Europe, mainland Europe, had basically been obliterated and destroyed as a result of World War II, fighting on both sides, particularly in Eastern Europe, but through Italy as well, Northern France and in Germany, huge amounts of destruction. These generally would be seen as the conditions that would be ripe for a communist takeover, very similar to the situation in 1917. You've got defeated countries, you've got huge amounts of poverty, infrastructures falling apart, and a lot of people turning against the pre-war consensus, the pre-war fascist ideas, but also against democracy and so on. Now, the key thing was that both sides had agreed at the conferences that occupied territories would be given free and fair elections to determine their own future. Now, elections were certainly held across Europe at this point. How free and fair they are is a matter of some conjecture. Obviously, it's hard to prove one way or the other. Certainly having the Red Army in great big force across the Eastern European states might well, or almost certainly did, influence that how some people cast their votes. But it's also possible that a lot of people did genuinely want to follow the communist way after the failures of fascism and capitalism as they saw it. So there was a lot of support for communism growing. Now, if we look at places like Poland, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, etc., various left-wing and communist parties did win elections in 1945 to 1947. In Hungary, the communists were the largest single party in the 1947 elections. There were coalitions with communists in Czechoslovakia. Romania elected a prime minister who was communist and so on. So the communists had done very well. Although, interestingly, even if there was intimidation and exploitation by the Red Army that was occupying, they very rarely won an outright majority control in any particular country. However, it is, you know, so maybe there were free and fair elections and people did choose them voluntarily. However, it's worth bearing in mind that in areas not controlled or liberated by the Red Army, like France, Italy, Austria, that did have quite active and popular communist parties, while the communists did gain some success and did do quite well in some elections, they never got to a position of power. So again, it's worth considering why that is. Maybe it's the free choice versus the intimidation of the Red Army. On top of that, what's telling is, while in 45, 46, 47, communists did get positions of power, once in power, they then exploited this to remove opposition, removing rival parties, banning them, removing coalition partners, imprisoning political opponents, and so on. And effectively, over these first few years, creating one-party states across the Eastern European territories, going down from Staten in the north, where East Germany started, all the way down to Trieste on the border between Italy and Yugoslavia. And this led Winston Churchill, who really, really hated communism, to make a speech in Missouri, America, in 1946, proclaiming that an Iron Curtain had descended and showing the difference between East and West. Now, as for the Allies, they certainly believed that this was Soviet domination and the elections hadn't been that free and fair. But at the same time, they didn't want to risk an outright confrontation. The Red Army was there in huge numbers and huge force. and the liberty or freedoms of the Poles, the Czechs, the East Berliners, East Germans, Hungarians, Romanians, etc., wasn't something they were prepared to go to war for. So by 1947, although some protests had been made, they also had to acknowledge that at the conferences, Eastern Europe had been deemed a Soviet sphere of influence, although Truman wasn't happy about that, and elections had been held, although maybe not that free and fair. So this is where Truman starts to formulate his doctrine. And the Truman Doctrine basically comes as a reaction to this, which is communism, where it currently is, in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, nothing America can do about that. It's communist. There's not a lot you can do. But while he's going to accept communism in those areas, he's not going to allow the expansion of communism to any new territories. So it's very much going to be about containing communism where it currently exists, as of 1947. And the first time this really came through was over Greece in 1947. So Greece had been fascist. It had been invaded then by the Italians and then by the Germans. And both communists and monarchists had risen up against this. And there was basically a civil war erupting, yet another civil war over Greece, with the British, because of Winston Churchill, very much taking the side of the monarchists and fighting the communists. Now, by 1947, it was clear the British couldn't afford to keep this going, and they were going to step back from it, which would have allowed the communists to gain control over Greece. However, the Americans, thanks to Truman, came forward and took over the funding of the war and essentially helped a very weak and not very popular monarchist regime to defeat the communist regime and keep Greece, well, to be call it democratic might be a stretch at the time, but at least not communist. And that was the first time Truman really set out his doctrine, that he was going to intervene using American military and American money to prevent the spread of communism. So the civil war in Greece in 1947 really establishes this principle of the Truman Doctrine, and shows Truman's acceptance of the borders of communism where it already existed, but that he wouldn't let it spread elsewhere. Now, the Truman Doctrine is the big umbrella policy that America will essentially follow, or try to follow at least, for the next 55 or so years. One aspect of the Truman Doctrine was obviously building up military strength and mutual protection. This will come through with the establishment in 1949 of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which was about collective responsibility. However, another side of that, if you like, if we call NATO and things like that the military side of it, the stick, then the carrot side of it was the Marshall Plan. So, as I mentioned earlier, Europe had been completely destroyed. And economically, it was in a terrible mess. And that's why communist parties had gained support, even in areas not controlled by the Red Army. So one of his generals, George Marshall, who'd gone to become a senator as well. But anyway, he joined the government. Basically, he came up with a plan that America would give money as a gift, as aid, to help rebuild the countries of any countries that wanted the aid in Europe. So it's a huge investment at the time, writing off their debt effectively, and then using billions of dollars at a time when billions of dollars was a huge amount. I mean, it's still quite a lot now, but, you know, 17 billion at the time, that was enormous. Basically, would give this to governments who would then buy goods from America. So it's kind of a two-way thing. They give money to help these countries rebuild economically to try and stop the spread of communism by removing the causes of communism. But at the same time, a lot of these countries would start because most of their economies have been destroyed, they'd be buying goods and services from America. So in a way, America would get money back and that would help them to establish prosperous capitalist regimes. So that was Marshall's plan. Now, it was really generous by the Americans, basically giving money away and to the European countries. Anyone could take it, including communist states. However, Stalin distrusted it. Stalin thought, quite rightly, it was an attempt to win the hearts and minds of the peoples of Eastern Europe and encourage them to turn towards capitalism rather than communism. And so he ordered a ban on any communist-controlled states, any that were members of his Communist Information Bureau, that's Cominform, which he used to meet the leaders of the communist parties of all the different countries, who had to be loyal and answer to him. And so he basically ordered them to refuse to accept it. This didn't do much good in countries like Italy and France, where the Communist Party had no power. But obviously in those communist states that were controlled or under the Soviet sphere of influence, had a huge effect. And so although some of them initially started taking money, like Czechoslovakia, they quickly had to stop taking money. And so the Marshall Aid did help the Western European states rebuild and helped to entrench the Cold War in many ways, because they started to take the money and become more prosperous. Took a while, but they started to rebuild and become more prosperous. And that was in contrast to what was happening in the Soviet Union. Stalin had produced an economic idea called Communist Economic Policy, or Comecon, not like the comic book convention, and Comecon. It was meant to coordinate all the industries and economic trade across the communist states, kind of as an alternative to the Marshall Aid. But basically, it meant the Soviet Union taking whatever they wanted from the Eastern European countries. And although it benefited the Soviet Union, it really didn't benefit the member states. So that's basically where we end up with. One slight consequence of all this was that because Yugoslavia had become communist kind of on its own grounds, Marshal Tito had led the push to liberate Yugoslavia, and so he was a bit more free and a bit more independent. Yugoslavia wasn't as dominated by the Red Army as others, so when Stalin ordered him not to accept martial aid, he said, well, I'm going to accept it. He was kicked out to Cominform, and so although Yugoslavia would remain communist, it was never part of the Warsaw Pact, and it kind of always remained slightly separate and independent. So it's sort of behind the Iron Curtain, but not fully behind the Iron Curtain. So as you can imagine, lots and lots of spy games would happen there, and lots of Westerners would go on holiday to places like, well, modern-day Croatia, because it was very nice. Anyway, so that's basically what happened in those interwar years, and the role of martial aid. Now, the last little topic to remember. Oh, actually, no. Do I need to tell you about Czechoslovakia? Not really. So I'm not going to. Anyway, again, basically, Czechoslovakia in 1948 wanted to take martial aid. They stood up to Stalin, a bit like Tito had in Yugoslavia, and the leader Jan Masaryk was mysteriously found dead, and anti-Soviet leaders were purged, which again shows Stalin's ruthless control and authority over the countries, and that these countries weren't going to be free. Perhaps more tellingly, America did nothing about this, and again that showed that Truman would allow the communists to keep control over the countries they already had control over. Ooh. Okay, so the last little bit then is the Berlin blockade and the Berlin airlift. Now, this happens in 1948. So the Iron Curtain, if you like, which is not a real thing, but it had been imagined, this boundary line between East and West Europe had been drawn up. But there was a slight problem, because just like the rest of Germany, Berlin, the capital city, had been divided into four zones. The French, British and US sectors, which is West Berlin, and East Berlin, which was controlled by the Soviet Union. Now, this meant there was effectively a gap or a hole in this Iron Curtain. And at this point, you could walk freely from one zone to another in Berlin. So you could effectively walk from capitalist side to the Western side. Now, there's no Berlin Wall. That doesn't come along till the 1960s. But Stalin still sees this as a potential threat and a humiliation, and he wants the British, French and US to get out of Berlin. Now, because of the atomic bomb that America has and Russia doesn't have at this stage, and because of the economic side of it, Stalin doesn't want to risk a full-on war. Okay, particularly Russia still is recovering itself from World War II. So he doesn't want to go with war about it. So he doesn't want to launch a campaign against America at this stage. Equally, he doesn't want to leave them there. At the same time, he doesn't want a unified Germany. He's worried that if Germany is unified and becomes an independent country, the Americans will use the martial aid and influence to allow it to basically go capitalist. He wants it to go communist, but he knows the British, French and Americans won't allow a whole Germany to unify and go communist. So there's a bit of an impasse going on here. So what Stalin decides to do is there's basically one road that linked Western Germany, or the US zones and the British zones in Western Germany, to West Berlin and the capital. Now, actually, a lot of the supplies and stuff had been going along the road, and they'd also been getting supplies in from elsewhere in Germany. What Stalin did in 1948 was he decided to simply close the borders and close this restriction. And as such, in June 1948, he cut off the supply routes between West Germany and West Berlin. That meant the population in West Berlin was in grave danger. They wouldn't be able to get supplies of food, of fuel, heating, etc. All of which had been supplied through this one road that led from West Germany to West Berlin. By closing the access roads, it was cut off. And Stalin's hope was that the Americans would just give up here and would take out the Western troops and Berlin would become fully German. However, if Truman had given in to this, it would have been a breach of his own doctrine, because it would have seen the expansion of communism into West Berlin. And it's also worth bearing in mind that 1948 was an election year in America. Always important to know this. And Truman was in for a really tough fight with the Republicans. Now, the Republican Party was seen as the hawkish party, the cold warriors, if you like, the ones that were really tough on communism. And the Democrats were portrayed quite often as soft on communism, too forgiving, a bit too left-wing and liberal. So in order to try and stave off Republican attacks, Truman had to show that he was tough and strong on communism, particularly as people considered him responsible in some way for the loss of Eastern Europe to communism. So in 1948, he was going to have to stand up to this attack. What did he choose to do? Well, he could have maybe tried to run the blockade using American military might, but considering the huge number of Red Army forces that were there already in Eastern Europe, that could have triggered a huge war. While, yes, he had nuclear bombs, actually, America didn't have that many at this stage, and they were reluctant. The moral questions were developing over whether or not to use them in a future war, or how they'd be deployed. At this stage, there's no missiles, they had to be flown, and it wasn't clear how they would be used. Certainly, their allies, Britain, France, Italy and so on, at this stage, weren't in any position to offer them much help. And it wasn't clear that the American public would actually want to go to war over West Berlin. So he couldn't do that. Equally, he couldn't let the people starve, because that would be America abandoning the Allies. And there was already criticism having kind of abandoned Czechoslovakia and the rest of Eastern Europe. So Truman had to do something short of military action. What he decided to do was launch a series of airlifts using planes that were flown around the clock from West Germany into West Berlin to supply the city with its fuel, food, clothes, everything that it would need. Now, economically, this makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. Okay, the costs were ridiculous. Flying in huge amounts of coal, it just makes no financial sense. The cost of bringing it in is more than the cost of the coal is actually worth. And Stalin knew that, and the hope was that Truman wouldn't supply this, wouldn't keep going. But he'd underestimated his opponent here. Because for Truman, and particularly with the election looming, the money didn't matter so much as keeping West Berlin in the democratic capitalist fold. So Truman supports this whole airlift, and it goes on round the clock. And he keeps it going all the way until May 1949. Now, it's a moment of huge tension, because had there been an attack on one of these planes, had Stalin ordered one of them to be shot down, that would have been an act of war. And again, Truman either would have had to show himself as weak, or by doing nothing, or he would have to take strong military action and basically start a whole war. So there was a huge amount of tension over what would happen in Berlin. Fortunately for Truman, particularly after he'd won the election and it was clear that he wasn't giving in, that he was going to keep going with this strategy, Stalin eventually, in May 1949, backed down and just quietly reopened the communications lines. The roads were opened and the Berlin airlift could be finished because it was no longer needed. And that was seen as a big victory by the West. It was a moment of high tension, but the West came out of it. Stalin, clear that Truman was not going to give back. Stalin realizes it's a bit of a pointless waste of time, and it's a moment of high tension and high energy. It's also worth bearing in mind that by 1949, he's close to having developed Soviet nuclear weapons, which will also help redress the balance of power. So the Berlin blockade was a real moment of high tension, and probably the first instance where there was a very real chance that a war could break out between the major powers. And that sets up Berlin as a flashpoint where, because it's behind the Iron Curtain, because it's basically it's this small little bubble of capitalism within the Soviet communist sphere of influence, conflicts will erupt over Berlin quite regularly as the two sides clash. And Berlin itself becomes a powerful symbol as a city divided of the whole nature of the Cold War. That will be reinforced when the Berlin Wall gets built in 1961. So it also shows that there is no way in which Germany is going to be unified. There's no way, having put all this effort into keeping West Berlin capitalist, that they're going to abandon West Germany to communism, and there's no way that Stalin's going to give up East Germany for capitalism. And it basically ends up leading to East Germany and West Germany developing as separate states effectively until unification in 1990. And that kind of sets the pattern of the Cold War, where both sides will square up over a point of principle or mutual supports of an ally, but won't actually go much further than that. So, yeah, effectively, that's the Berlin blockade and the Berlin airlift and why it was so significant. Okay, just a couple of last little bits on this. One of the consequences of this, perhaps most important, was the creation of NATO, which I mentioned earlier. Now, NATO, if you like, is the military side of the Truman Doctrine. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization was an agreement of mutual protection. So the idea was that if one member state was invaded or attacked, it would be an attack on all member states. And while that sounds all very equal and fair, what it basically meant was any countries that signed up to NATO and became part of NATO, if they were attacked, the USA would automatically come to their defense. So it was a commitment by America to the Western forces because they were the ones that were most vulnerable. The Atlantic Ocean, the Arctic Circle, the Pacific, America's isolated from the Soviet Union. The Red Army is not going to be marching into New York anytime soon. But West Berlin, West Germany, France, Italy, Austria, these are all on the border with the Iron Curtain. They are at real risk. So this is America making a commitment to them and trying to make sure that the Soviet Union won't dare risk sweeping up these countries or trying to pick them off one at a time, because that would potentially trigger a war with America. So that's to justify America backing its Western allies, which, you know, is very nice for them. Eventually, after a few, so that was in April 1949. And then by 1955, Stalin created his own version, which was the Warsaw Pact. Similar idea of mutual protection across the communist states, not including Yugoslavia, because they'd been kicked out of the whole agreement. But collective security. To be honest, it didn't really mean anything. It's not like West Germany was likely to invade East Germany anytime soon. But what it meant was again, if there was an attack on one of them, or if the Americans encroached into East Berlin, that would justify the Soviets declaring war. It was more a point of principle, but still, it had a huge impact. Now, other things that happened that's just worth bearing in mind in this early stages was actually, yeah, China had also become communist by the time we get to the 1950s. Or by the time we were in the 1950s. And that, again, was a failure of the Truman Doctrine, which I'll talk more about next time when I look at the Korean War. But that expansion of China, you know, the largest population country in the world, going communist, was a huge humiliation and failure of the Truman Doctrine. And it meant there was a huge potential rival to the Soviet Union. But that's more for next time. And I'll look particularly at the Korean War. And obviously we'll get Stalin's death in 1953. But what does all this mean? Well, effectively, we've got the origins of the Cold War. Now, I know topics talk about who was to blame for it. It's really what was to blame. What was to blame was the mutual distrust both sides had for each other. You had the clash of personalities, particularly Truman taking over from Roosevelt and the lack of personal relations. And you had the disappearance of the common enemy, Nazi Germany, which brought them together and forced them to work together on some things, like a partitioned Berlin. But once that enemy had gone, there was nothing left to unify them, and they started turning and competing against each other. Would this have happened without World War II? Possibly, although there may have been other factors. But after World War II, only the USA and USSR were left as major superpowers. They'd been forced to work together, but now they turned against each other. Both individually were far too powerful for any other country to deal with, and it meant that there was a very real risk if they went to war with each other, particularly with nuclear weapons, it could lead to a whole end of the world, which people were genuinely scared and worried about. And they've got this clash of ideologies, they're mutually opposed to each other, different interpretations, cultures, and all of these things come together. And in a series of events lead to increased hostilities between the two. And I think it's really that clash of ideologies that makes sense. Both are absolutely convinced that their system is right and the only way for future world development. It's going to make it very hard for them to work together mutually, especially as both view the other one as fundamentally opposed to them and seeking their destruction. Communism sought the destruction of the capitalist state. Capitalism, to survive, wanted to destroy communism, and there was a whole history and legacy of that. And it's that attitude and that mutual distrust of each other that really causes all the events and tensions that escalate the Cold War into a very real and tangible thing, summed up by the Berlin blockade and Berlin airlift. So, yeah, it's that clash of ideologies, I would say, more than anything else. And also the devastation of Europe that really leads to the Cold War getting going. So I hope that helps. I hope that's clarified some things. Or if not, maybe it's helped you fall asleep whilst doing some revision. Anyway, whatever the situation, I hope you're doing well. I hope you're in a good place with all your work and stuff and you're not too stressed about it. And I will speak to you again soon. Take care and thank you for listening.